And we are back. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Daily Dots. And I am joined, as always, with Brain Trust, Chase Taylor. Not a lot going on today, Chase. Kind of just bounced around flat on the indexes, as has been the case for going on what feels like 13, 14 years now. You're, of course, going to get the little bump positive at the end of the day. That's just – is that always been the case? Just the regularity of the way you rally in the last – it doesn't matter what it is. It just seems like you're always going to get a bump in the last half hour.
We don't always, but we do often. And I think it's just the institution coming in and putting money to work again.
Yeah, and mutual fund orders that get logged in at the end of the trading day and all that kind of stuff. But the consistency of it is remarkable. But anyway, yeah, other than that, pretty much of a flat trading day. Only real thing, people are getting really excited about Apple. I'm not sure if that's short covering unwinding. We got out of our short position and booked a profit overall. But any insights on or is it just as simple as Tim Cook uttered the magic words of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I think they're working on a lot of stuff that has been talked about here and there. They have earnings coming up. Whenever you see these big tech companies gap up 15% on earnings, it makes you not really want to be too short. In fact, they're working on new products that they're going to be unveiling and talking about in the months to come. Like, some of them sound like they could be pretty good mousetraps for AI stuff. Obviously, if they can turn Siri into a really, really good AI, personal bot, then that would be a big deal. So it does not seem crazy to me that they might be able to come up with some stuff in the next year that makes them more money, since, you know, the last couple of years they've been unable to make more money. So this one's not crazy, I don't think. But at the same time, we did close above the 50-day moving average today, but with at one point, I mean, we were at like 175, 176 at one point today, and we closed at 173.5. So it was a very ugly daily candle. It closed at the absolute bottom of the range of the day. So who knows? I don't want to be short for earnings.
No, and theoretically, it makes perfect sense to me because, again, this is one of those things that is just frustrating in this market, which I will continue to call this dumbest market of all time. And just so people know, when I say that, I've been doing this long enough. I'm not saying it because things don't go my way. I'm saying it in reference to, and I've used this example before, Chase, but I'll continue to go back to it because it just left a mark on me. And it was our Facebook trade going into 2022. I remember, I believe it was like December of 2021. We'd had a really good run on Meta, and I was talking to my buddy that works at a hedge fund down in San Francisco, and he was like, yeah, we're getting out of Meta because of the spend that they're putting on the metaverse. I was like, well, yeah, Rob, but everybody knows that. His name's Rob, by the way. I go, Rob, but everybody knows that. How is that not baked into the price? And he goes, go back and look at the price action, man. No matter how many times he said it, the stock never built it in. And I look back on it and I go, you know what? He's right. You know what? Let's pivot. We'll swap out Facebook for Amazon here, whatever. Well, that quarter comes out and they announce what Zuckerberg was saying for the previous 12 months. And the spend showed up for the metaverse and the stock just got drilled. And it confirmed to me, and I don't know why that is, and I can't definitively look at you and tell you it would have been different any other time. What I can tell you is, a guy that's been operating and observing markets for a really long time, I've never seen markets do things like that. And I feel like you see him do it on a regular basis. And usually it's to the upside. And I think you're sort of seeing that in China right now, right? Or excuse me, in Apple right now. Cook comes out issuing the magic words, AI in relationship to the phone. And you sit back and go, guys, one of the main reasons that Apple phones or Apple stock has been quote unquote struggling. Now, you know, what are they? You're 4 or 5% off an all-time high, so I don't really see that as a big struggle. Maybe it's 10% off an all-time high. But, you know, not a huge struggle, especially when you look at the fact that they're not growing and they're still sporting a multiple in the upper 20s, right? But my whole point was saying the there's a lot of layups that this market just doesn't get. And the big issue that's the big headwind for Apple is the fact that the Chinese government doesn't want their people, especially employees of the Chinese government, using their phones. Whether they launch AI-enabled phones or not, that doesn't change any of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny because it's a similar story for we were talking to with Tesla.
Yeah,
the Chinese government is kind of made it clear how they feel about that too, and they're also not allowed to go in a lot of government facilities.
Yeah,
you're about 13% off the high school.
Oh, okay, so more off the high than we thought.
I wasn't sure either.
But no, I just and again, I'm not saying. Look, I might be wrong. Maybe there is something great coming out on Apple's earnings. I just the way that this market doesn't build in a lot of information. You know, everybody just off the cuff or go, well, all available information is priced in. You go, no, it's not. No, it's not. These moves don't make any sense. And what you often see over time is. It sort of feels like, and you see it to the downside too, but it sort of feels like what panic selling in a good name used to look like. You know, where you're like, oh, these people are overwrought. Just wait, it'll bounce back. I feel like a lot of times to the upside now you're getting that. You're like, oh, here's this idiocy. Let's wait till reality hits, and then they'll come back around to their senses. It just increasingly feels like that. I don't know where to. It's probably just because, it's probably just behavioral bias. The market's gone up so long, everybody feels bulletproof, that kind of thing. Everybody, I think there's very much that feeling, and yeah. I kind of think
value investing now is just buy the Mag 7 that's sold out.
Yeah, right. That's the modern value investing. Yeah. Right. And the other thing, too, is that I think that investors are trained in this market unlike any other market that's ever existed. They're not jumping on these stocks just so they don't miss out on the next 5 to 10. They're jumping on these stocks so they don't miss out on the next 150% move in the next 6 months. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's the fear. Now, for those of you that were, it was funny because, well, you'll hear things all over the place. For those of you that didn't think we were being aggressive enough on the Tesla short, this today is precisely why we were quick to take profits onto the Tesla short. And it's also why we didn't go back in any significant way after that initial pop. We added a little bit back to that previous short, but not much. And why? Again, just go look at the history of the stock. This thing does not need, and I think the same is true for most of the Mag 7. I think Tesla is an outlier there. But you don't need good things to happen for these companies to go up. You just need, like I've said before, and I'll say it again, Tesla is the dumbest shareholder base in the history of stocks. And I don't mean that to denigrate the people holding the stock. I mean that as a warning to not short it. Because all you got to do is have Musk come out, like the announcement that the Chinese government's going to let them test FSD. That's fine. They're way behind Huawei on FSD development. And you don't think Huawei is going to get the fast lane treatment from the Chinese government and Tesla's not? You know what I mean? Like, of course, that doesn't improve Tesla's ability to sell cars in China. And that's really the issue. And in that way, I think Tesla and Apple are up against the same thing. I mean, if you think Apple is going to hold global market share while the Chinese government is stepping on Apple phones and encouraging people not to buy them, you're out of your mind. Isn't Apple, Chase, you may know, China has to be their second or third largest market if you split it apart by countries. Has to be.
Say it again.
If you split the world apart by countries and not regions, China has to be their second or third largest country in terms of people using and buying iPhones.
Yeah, I would assume.
Yeah.
It's hard for not to be.
Yeah, until that flips around, until that pressure isn't there from China, I've got a very hard time seeing Apple's numbers improve dramatically. Right? Meaning this, will people jump on an AI-enabled phone that they come out? Well, sure, but I don't know. I kind of feel like they're losing their luster a little bit, meaning you didn't see a big sales surge coming off of their titanium phone. Now, an AI enabled Siri is different than a titanium covering on a phone that hasn't changed. But anyway, so let's get to the rest of it though. Not a lot happened in rates today. I thought it was a little interesting that rates were down. That was a bit of a head scratcher to me. What'd you see there?
Yeah, so notably there, we got the first leg of the QRA today. And the Treasury had to up how much issuance they're going to have in the quarter, and it was more than people expected. I don't have an opinion on how Wednesday goes on the composition. I think they'll probably keep it roughly the same on composition, even though whenever you say you need whatever, I think it was like $40 billion more than expected for the quarter. So at this point, whatever you want to do with your composition is fine, but you still have to sell $40 billion more than everyone thought.
Why would rates pull back on that?
So they were already down. They went up a little bit after the announcement, and then they went right back down. But stocks notably went up. They were like up like, I don't know, what are like 40 bips, and they went to negative like real quick on the announcement. So stocks kind of noticed. But then, you know, last half hour of the day, like, I don't care anymore. So I thought that was notable. And I think the guy's name is John Comiskey. He does a lot of work on this stuff, like hardcore detail work to try and figure out where this stuff's going to go. And his number for Q3 is like massive, like $900 billion worth. So this QRA was, I mean, you're already, you know, a decent little jump in issuance. And then Q3, it sounds like it'll be a very big pig in a python for issuance. And whenever you have these big numbers, like, sure, like you can lean on bills, but you can't avoid coupons. So the issuance on the long end is going to be big. The issuance on the front end is going to be massive. And at some point, you're going to overwhelm even the front end after the Fed cuts rates. When they cut rates and everyone's like, cool, I don't really want the CD anymore or this money market fund anymore. I think even on that front end, you try to jam through, you know, trillions and trillions of issuance and without money market funds being the hot commodity they are now. Even that. So maybe that's all down the line, and maybe the Fed just buys it and it doesn't matter. But for now, it looks a little weird. And in my opinion, it kind of puts pressure on the Fed to, on Wednesday, say, go ahead and announce the taper and for that to start. I would think this summer. Like, I think the taper has to start pretty soon here of QT, especially knowing that we have that much more issuance to come.
I get, you know what I get the feeling of? I get the feeling of this whole dynamic we're talking about in stocks. It could be wrong. I just feel like it's going to play. It just feels to me like it's going to play on bonds.
And real quick, typically people buy bonds whenever the yen gets pushed higher. So I think the intervention in the yen, at least for the day, had some people reflexively buying treasuries.
Yeah.
I think that's dumb. But.
Yeah, which I understand, because it's where the new school and the old school collides. Because meaning if you – I don't think the reaction from the Japanese investment public is going to see what's going on with yen dollar and to turn around and buy treasuries. I think they're much more likely to turn around and buy the Magnificent Seven and buy gold.
Right.
Right.
And in order to like really have a successful intervention, they're going to, like, Japan will have to sell treasuries. So like that's not really good for them either.
Yeah.
I think people look back at history and they go, oh well, every time this happens, the treasuries will. Yeah, but the world changed a lot since those previous times. But those old habits die hard. So I think that's a big reason you got treasury yields down today.
I think the other thing that's happened too behaviorally, and I get it, I understand why it has. Markets just behave more differently now than they used to. Meaning, I think one of the reasons that you'll see things sleepwalk, like we were talking about with Tesla or in our experience with Meta, but you know. I think the reason that you see things sleepwalk where in past periods markets would have built that into price is just because everybody's so used to central banks coming in and anesthetizing every risk. And I think it's made markets dumber. And it feels to me like that's sort of going on with bonds right now. Like, it could be wrong. Wouldn't surprise me. I don't feel a high conviction one way or the other. But like you and I have talked about so much, there is such a mismatch in the amount of bond issuance that has to come out, that's coming out regardless of what anybody does, right? And who's available there to buy it. There's just a number mismatch. And it is not being reflected in the yields at present, right?
100%.
Now, how are they going to deal with that? I'll tell you how they're going to deal with it right now. And I know you've said the same thing. The Fed will have to start buying bonds again.
Or shove them down the bank.
Yeah, but until that becomes apparent, I do not think anything going on with rates is bullish.
But why wouldn't rates go make those things happen? You know, typically that's what bond markets do. They're like, you know what you have to do, so we're going to make it.
We're going to make you. And that has gone away. You don't see – everybody still talks about bond vigilantes. I'm like, guys, they went on vacation at some point, and if you think they're back, they're not back in 2022.
They had a good 2 weeks in the UK, and that was about it.
Yeah, and everybody goes, well, what about 2022? And I look at them and I go, 2022 had to be the most orderly 25% sell-off you've ever seen. There was never any panic. I don't think the VIX even peaked above 30 that entire year, right? There was no point where anything got out of control. And it's just if when you look at what the Treasury's up against and you look at our overall debt loads, you look at all these things, I just have a very hard time believing that you're not going to see more noise. I'll make this statement, and I'm sure I'll live to regret it because I'm going to make an absolute statement here. I think it is inevitable that you see a really big, violent bond sell-off. And what I mean by that is I think that's what it will take to get the Fed to start buying bonds again. And there is no way that the regular market, right, just the market the way it is, in my opinion, the number of mismatches is too large. The Fed cannot continue running QT with issuance like this coming out of the Treasury without them losing control of the long end. I just don't see how it's possible. There's just not enough – there aren't enough sponges out there to soak up that amount of liquidity.
Yeah.
Or that amount of –
QT will be over soon, but I think the to me it's hard to imagine them going that very long without having restarting QB, but just for no other reason than keeping the government financed at a reasonable rate.
Yeah, I just don't see
unless they change the rules where the banks can just warehouse them for them and essentially, you know, no risk and no cost to them.
They effectively have done that. They've effectively already done that. I mean, that's what BTF.
Right, but that's gone now. You know.
But what have we seen?
They had to pay. They had to pay. Depending on where the rate was, but at one point they had to pay a penalty rate in order to do that. What I'm saying is, like, no kidding. Like, just you can just hold these, and we treat it like you don't even have it. Essentially, like zero risk for you, and hey, you get to make your whatever, and like it's free money.
But I think that's inevitable. And I think that
it is.
I think the other thing
is a private sector.
And it's stealth QE.
Yeah. And it will happen.
Yeah, it's stealth QE because rather than buying the bonds, the way that the mechanisms and the way that they go about doing that and saying, listen, you can hold these on your bonds. And it's actually similar to pre 08-09. Meaning it used to be if you only held AAA rated debt on your balance sheet, if you were a bank, you didn't even have to report it on your balance sheet. You could report it as cash. That was one of the biggest issues, right? If you look back at the Big Short, you know, all that kind of stuff, they had all these AAA rated mortgage-backed securities that were just, if you looked at the balance sheet, all you saw was cash. You didn't realize that you know, the cash was the problem, right? So, BTFP, and it's kind of like understanding we need to develop a term for this, central bank psychology, right? Like there should be a term. But like BTFP, in my opinion, was just one step closer to them doing exactly what you just said.
Yeah, it's just trying to euthanize that part of the balance sheet.
Yeah, getting rid of duration risk. Yeah, and they're going to have to let the banks. I mean, there isn't a bank because let's say
– banks have the balance sheet because it can be whatever they want it to be.
Yeah.
And you really need them to do it. So,
well, yeah,
it's a marriage made in heaven. There's no way it doesn't happen.
No, and the Fed just says you don't have to. You no longer have to mark your treasuries at par. You don't have to mark them to market.
Yeah, exactly.
And then that's probably a step closer to potentially making automatic allocations inside of 401k plans and making people own bonds inside of 401k plans.
Yeah, and to me, that is just keep them all warehousing them on the bank's balance sheets. Essentially, it's more like monetizing the debt than QE is. So,
yeah.
And I think it would be more stimulative and inflationary.
That's a really interesting point that I hadn't thought about. QE uses bank reserves. If you're housing them on the bank's balance sheet, the bank's buying those bonds with money. Right? Cash.
I think you can make that case, but I'm not 100% sure.
Can the bank use bank reserves to buy bonds from the Treasury?
Yeah. So like within reserves, like, yeah, that's like fungible.
Okay. Okay. Now they can't use bank reserves to buy from another bank though.
They can. So like bank reserves is like it's like monopoly money for banks and the Fed.
Right.
It doesn't escape there per se, but within the banking system, you can go around and move through and change hands and buy things.
Okay, so then why would you think then? So why do you think that the banks holding the bonds is more inflationary?
I don't know. I'll have to cancel this out because I want to make sure I'm getting it right. But my first blush thought of it was, you know, in QE, like you're not making money, and then you know banks can truly just make money out of thin air and just be like, this exists. It's now a deposit, right? But like you're saying, though, like would it be like reserves or like more like deposit money? And from that standpoint, maybe it would still be, you know, self-euthanized. This is where me not being a plumbing expert gets in my way, and I'll have to like A, ask some smart people, or B, you know, get out the wiring diagram of the whole thing.
You know what? And look, I think that kind of logic is very popular in Intuit, and everybody likes to hear it because everybody wants to get really esoteric and granular.
Sure.
I think that a lot of that misses the forest for the trees.
Right. But that answer is like, it's more money than reserves. You know, it's more money than the Fed doing it, then it would be more inflationary, more impactful, more, you know, stimulus for all of it.
I think the main lesson to take away, to keep it at the forefront of your mind, regardless of short-term market movements, even if they're violent and they're strong, I think the main takeaway that people should have is, look, the bloodletting that everybody, or that so many, you know, financial justice warriors and everything, the bloodletting that everybody's waiting for, it isn't going to happen until they've pulled every single lever.
Yeah, they still got big ones.
And they still have big levers to pull. And if you don't think they're going to pull them, you're not paying attention. And I know it doesn't seem just. I know it doesn't seem right. But where have you been for the last 15 years? Because they're just going to keep kicking that can until they're out of rope.
Yeah, the sidearm is about to run out of ammo, and everyone's like, "Oh, they're it. That's it. They're done." But they're about to toss their sidearm on the ground and unsling the big guy. You know, so like,
yeah, there's a couple.
Ain't seen nothing yet. It's reality.
Well, yeah, they're oh, his sidearm's running out of business. And I'm looking behind him, and I'm like, yeah, I see a couple 50 cals and a Mark 19 coming right behind him.
None of them being dead is not really going to be a problem.
No. But yeah, if you're sitting around waiting for things to get back to normal and for markets to function in a traditional way,
or we'll cut spending and you know raise taxes and it'll all be over.
yeah, let's take some odds on that. Okay, what do we have on the docket for this week? I know we've still got earnings going on. Not a lot to glean from earnings. I think earnings kind of back up where you and I thought they were, which is, I think generically speaking, you know, again, of course, it's due to the, in our opinion, the deficits they're running, but the economy is still growing. I think that the earnings are very idiosyncratic. I mean, certain things are doing good, certain things aren't. I don't really see that changing. What do we have on the docket, though, other than just more earnings coming up?
Yeah, so it's another Super Bowl week. Tomorrow we have the employment cost index, which is the most important wage proxy out there. It only comes out quarterly. So that would be big. We also have some home prices tomorrow and some consumer confidence numbers from Conference Board. But then, obviously, importantly, on the week, Wednesday is Fed Day. We'll also have ADP jobs that day, S&P, PMIs, construction spending, JOLTS, job openings, ISM. So Wednesday is a monster day. And the second half of QRA, where Janet tells us how many bills and coupons he's going to issue. So just monster Wednesday. Thursday, we'll have job cuts, productivity, jobless claims, factory orders, durable goods, and then Friday's Jobs Friday. So that enough said for Friday. So jobs in the Fed, ISM, just huge, huge.
What I'm interested in is, I don't really understand, as long as people are soaking up the short term, like granted, I wouldn't be doing this in the first place, and I think Janet Yellen will go down in history, in my opinion, as one of the biggest disasters to ever run the Treasury due to that, you know,
not terming out.
Yeah, and I don't mean that politically at all, and I don't mean there's a shot at her personally, but I just sit there and I'm like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
We'll say this. Not terming out now, like she's
not turning out now makes some sense.
It'd be insane to turn out. Like, if you can get it all, you could just transform the whole thing into bills and just keep rolling it. And then eventually, you theoretically, you know, you get rates a lot lower, then you start turning it out, right?
Yeah. So
that makes sense. But I think they probably over-anchor on their ability to get rates back down a lot and re-term out in the future. But
well, the other thing, too, is it's classic and perfect Fed to me. I think that there's a big assumption, and the Fed always makes really big assumptions. I think the assumption that they think there will be substantially lower rates in the immediate future or in the sometime near future that will allow them to turn it out, I personally think they missed their shot. I think it's I think it's going to take them a lot longer to get back there than they think. And I think it's going to be a much uglier backdrop when they get back there.
Yeah, and pumping it all in bills should make these short-term interest costs just brutal. So this time next year, if you haven't cut rates, I mean, the interest costs at that point will be, I don't know, like 1.4 trillion, probably something like that, like huge.
I know it has – none of this is good for anybody. I can't help but to get – excited is the wrong word because I'm not excited for bad things to happen. Yeah, but it really is intriguing because you watch them running out of road. You watch them running out of options. And they, like you said, they still have big ones left. And I'm not understating that. But it is amazing to me the certainty of what's coming at us. You know what I mean?
Right.
Again, it's just
they have
math.
Big ones left, but like ones you they can't talk about in polite company. The ones they really don't want to have to do.
Well, yeah, because I will say this. I think many of the big levers they have left is also pulling those levers will be the acknowledgement that they're out of levers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? And when you get to a point
where, like when you're playing Nintendo as a kid and you start blaming your controller. You're out of excuses. It's the controller's fault.
Well, hold on.
Now, that's where they're going to go. They're going to be like, that's my controller. I got the bad controller.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
I'll be wrong. Congress's fault, really. But.
And I think that that's sort of what you're seeing right now in commodity land. I think that you're watching commodities beginning to sniff that out, right? The certainty of the fix that the Fed is in. But my question is what is the market going to look like where it's universally recognized that Fed and central banks are out of leverage?
And I think equity valuations partially explain it to you, where like equity markets kind of looking at it going like, you guys have bad choices coming up, and we think you're going to pick the route that adds to our earnings significantly in the next decade. So we got to reprice higher.
And that is a completely rational conclusion to come from based on the behavior of central banks over the last 15 years. I mean, nobody has been tough at any point. Like you and I have talked about, and I know people probably think you're kicking a dead horse, but there's a terminology in mathematics that I'm forgetting about this, or I'm forgetting what it's called, but it's like the further you go down a path, even if you're not cognizant of it, even if you're not making decisions based on that, but the further you go down a path, just by definition of you being further down it, makes the switching cost more expensive, right? Like meaning, and I think you're there now, which is the cost of ceasing emergency activities or emergency policy would usher in the exact same outcome that you were trying to avoid in the first place when you started the emergency activity, right? So contrary to what the Fed thinks, I don't think time is on their side. I think it's the other thing. I think every single day that goes by, the pressure builds against them. Right, because what keeps happening? Debt issuance continues rolling, right? Like the problem just gets bigger and bigger by magnitude.
Right, the training wheels between the wheels.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
You can't really take them off.
Yeah, no, you can't. I mean, you can't. You and I both know what would happen to this market if central banks went, you know what? We've learned the mistakes of the last decade and a half. We're no longer playing this game. We're going to not look, you know, if they said that, it'd be chaos.
Yeah.
The whole world would go under.
Yeah, when everything just. It's very like a reminds you of like a ecology stuff where when everything adapts to something, like now all of a sudden, if you can remove that new stimulus, I mean, it's just a giant shock to the whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
Because it's all adapted and evolved around the new reality.
And the
so every day you leave it like that, it just becomes.
Yeah.
You said something earlier that this kind of made the market dumber. And I think I think you just kind of look at it like the average investor, I think you still have to put in the same amount of time to try to figure out upside. I think when the average investor is thinking about downside, they kind of half think about downside because they know that somebody's at least half got their back on the downside. So like, why do I need to do like a crazy model on downside risks? You can't get too bad. And there's the upside, like, man, you better figure out who the big winner is. So I think everyone just spends all their time thinking about that.
Yeah.
So like, in that sense, the market is better because you don't have to think about the downside the way you used to, unless you're peddling in small cap, like, you know, just super junky stuff.
But yeah, and it doesn't mean that there's not still systemic risk present. I think there is systemic risk, but I just think the disproportionate amount of that systemic risk, if you want to see where it resides, go look at central bank balance sheets.
If you want to know your risk, you need to know where what you hold, where the circuit breaker is to get help.
Right.
So if you own JP Morgan, Chase, you know your circuit breaker. I mean, you're top of the stack, right? You own that bad boy, and this starts getting squirrely. Like, the circuit breaker pops and you come in with it.
Well, if you want to get better than that, send them.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, they've got.
There are some people that aren't. They're too big to fail. At the end
of the day. You got the Burnank on the
too connected to fail.
No. Yeah. Well, no, that's why I've said to people, they're like, they're paying him $4 million a year. And I go, yeah, why do you think? Ken Griffin's a pretty astute investor.
That's probably
investor.
A wonderful investment.
Oh, the ROI. The ROI he got on that alone during COVID was worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you don't think the Fed stepping in there to buy CLOs and Fallen Angels and all that other kind of stuff they were buying, if you don't think that wasn't at least in some part due to ex-FOMC members that are now working for the hedge funds. I just think it's funny because the two biggest hedge funds, that, if I'm not mistaken, that employ the most ex-FOMC members, were also the ones running the biggest risk parity funds in the world.
Very true, yeah.
Right? Bridgewater and Citadel, right? And they had the Fed step in and buy CLOs and Fallen Angels and stuff like that for the first time in history. And like you said, I think it's messed up. I think it's a hallmark of a messed up system. That being said, I would like to think that I'd behave differently, but if I'm in their shoes and it's not illegal, I'm probably doing the same thing.
I mean, if you're doing your competitors well. And
yeah.
So.
Yeah, you got to take advantage of all the loopholes you got available to you. Anyway, anything else that we need to be paying attention to? I can't think of anything really important that came up. It's not pretty strong. At risk of even beating a dead horse, but the commodity and metal sector is looking really strong.
Yeah, I mean, copper has been especially on a just massive tear of late. But even gold and silver have been, you know, they got rinsed early last week, and they've been kind of hanging in pretty well since. Oil struggling a little bit, but that was more of a getting a little more excited about a possible ceasefire. So every time you get that, oil's going to pick up. And if you actually get like a legit ceasefire, oil is probably going to get hit for 5-6.
Because why not?
That seems roughly to me to be right for the premium that's putting in it right now. Even though I think it's worth what it's priced at now, but I do think it would get hit hard day of. But I think if it gets hit 5-6%, then you see Russia but China go in and start buying because they've been kind of taking it easy buying lately. Maybe that's why. But yeah. Uranium had a very nice update today. So there are, commodities stick strong. I will say this. I think commodities, they're at some risk Wednesday. Like if Powell comes out more hawkish than people expect, I would say a good, like a lot more hawkish than people expect. If you put a hike back on the table, like firmly, something like that, then I think you could see commodities also just kind of join this party of like, uh-oh, no thank you.
And it would make all the sense if he did that. At the same time, I just highly doubt it. The guy has had so many opportunities at so much less costly times to talk tough, and he's just avoided it every turn. And now I think he's reaping the whirlwind for it. But
yeah, the rest of the FMC's like really hawked it up versus where they were 2 months ago. But he has a little bit, but like not like the rest of the committee has. The rest of the committee is like really. I mean, Austin Goolsbee pivoted.
Which is hard for me to understand. All further than that, I mean, how long have we been talking about how for a while there, Jay Powell felt like the most responsible and the most hawkish member pretty much all the time.
Yeah, he was like Volcker Shadow, you know, Now he feels like, you know, he's wearing the Burns costume.
I know. It kind of makes you wonder if, you know, maybe somebody built a nice little dossier on him. I'm not trying to be conspiratorial. We don't need to inject conspiracies into this. No, I think it's fascinating that as hawkish as he is, and as many look, I think that being the
honestly, I just think he genuinely thinks that 5.5 is restrictive. And I think as long as he gives it time, everything's fine. That might be right, but it's certainly not as restrictive as they thought it was.
Well, it's not. Look, in and of itself, I think he's 100% correct. The question is what is the Treasury doing on the other side of it? And what is the U.S. government doing on the other side of it? Right? All things are not created equal. I mean, I think 5.5 is overly restrictive.
It should be.
Yeah. If it's normal,
right?
If you're not dumping 354 billion in the market every other quarter, right? You know, and running 6.5% debt, but like you and I have talked about it. Like, I'm looking at him going, buddy, you're playing the interest rate game here. I don't really think it matters as long as the government's running deficits.
Especially the last few years, but even now, like short-term interest rates are like the little kid with the fake steering wheel in the back seat. Like that's monetary policy. That's just true. It doesn't mean it stays like that forever. People have to refi. Like refiing into 5.5, that's not cute.
No.
But it happens so slow. Like it's just harder to. One thing I did want to mention before we go, only like little nugget I wrote down today was that hotel revenue per available room, also known as RevPAR, down year over year for the first time. So finally, hotel occupancy rates and revenue metrics are starting to kind of feel a bit of a pinch, which I found noteworthy because that sector was, just so leisure hospitality, just so hot. For so long, and definitely longer than I expected it to be, but coming back to Earth.
So hot, it's so hot right now. Reminds me, I was waiting my 13-year-old.
I just watched Frozen every day.
Oh yeah, in our house it was called Fronus. We inverted the Z in the end, right? Yeah, my whole life was Frozen songs for like two years.
At least it's good. It's a good movie.
It is. It is good. But yeah, it reminds me. You don't watch movies with your kids; you live them for 6 days.
True. I feel like I could write a PhD dissertation on Norway.
Yeah, I'm sure you could. All right, pal. Well, until tomorrow, then. That's all we got for today, and we'll be back again tomorrow as always, and hopefully you'll join us again. Until then, you're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.